Against a backdrop of discouraging news from Iraq, as well as a mounting chorus of criticism specifically aimed at all three men, particularly Tenet, who had reportedly described the flawed Iraq WMD intelligence as a slam dunk, and Bremer, who had made several major miscalculations during the early months of the occupation, the ceremony drew plenty of criticism. Wasn't this supposed to be an administration that prided itself on results and believed in responsibility and accountability? If so, why the rush to hand out medals to people who had helped organize what was now looking like a badly botched, ill-conceived war? The growing backlash against the war threatened to engulf the president himself. At Bush's end-of-year news conference on December 20th, he was pressed to defend his Secretary of Defense. He did so in a personal way. "I know Secretary Rumsfeld's heart. I know how much he cares for the troops. He and his wife go out to Walter Reed in Bethesda all the time to provide comfort and solace. I have seen the anguish in his, or heard the anguish in his voice, and seen his eyes when we talk about the danger in Iraq, and the fact that youngsters are over there in harm's way. And he's a good, decent man. He's a caring fellow. Sometimes perhaps his demeanor is rough and gruff, but beneath that rough and gruff, no-nonsense demeanor is a good human being who cares deeply about the military and deeply about the grief that war causes." It was a typical assessment by Bush, who often speaks about the people he likes in terms of their inner character, a good man, a decent man, rather than in terms of their concrete behaviors and actions. Bush didn't try to defend Rumsfeld's badly chosen words in Kuwait or his errors in judgment over the management of the war. Instead, he simply assessed the hidden qualities of the man as if these outweighed his actions and erased their negative consequences. One might call this a redemptive Christian perspective in which forgiveness is seen as washing away every misdeed. But it didn't jibe with the self-image of an administration supposedly focused on accountability and results, nor did it satisfy the growing unhappiness of Americans who were wondering whether their children and their treasure were being squandered to no good purpose. In the same conference, following a strategy we discussed behind the scenes, the president also tried to give what would be referred to in the media as a candid and sober assessment of the situation in Iraq. He spoke about the suicide bombings and IEDs, and he acknowledged that difficulties remained. He also left the impression that our troops would need to remain in Iraq for a while, without saying specifically how long. The next day's Washington Post poll showed that 56% of Americans now believed the war was a mistake and not worth fighting. A majority also said Rumsfeld should resign. The administration had tried positive spin, denial, and now, belatedly, candor and realism, but to no avail. The stark news on the ground was conveying its own message, and it was one the American people found increasingly troubling. But those of us inside the White House, as we headed into the new year, missed the multiplying warning signs. The president's approval rating was shaky, hovering just above the majority mark, the lowest it had been prior to any previous State of the Union address. Clearly, the president received no post-election bounce. The goodwill evident 4 years earlier, as he began his presidency, was nowhere to be found, and Bush was doing little to build any. He seemed determined to play the game Washington's way, not appreciating how much his policies and actions had contributed to poisoning the atmosphere. The narrow election victory supplied no real mandate. There was only division and polarization, and none of us in the president's inner circle seemed to realize how problematic it was at the time. Instead, we clung to the notion of a mandate, refusing to accept it for what it was, an illusion. And all the while, the situation in Iraq continued to worsen. As far as the president and his foreign policy team were concerned, the strategy was in place and the resources were in position to confront the approaching storm. Our troops would continue to aggressively pursue the insurgents and terrorists. Our diplomats would continue to push the political process forward. The January elections were a foremost priority, a potential turning point that might give hope to Iraqis and dampen the will and spirit of the insurgency. After a provisional government had been elected, the focus could shift to smaller reconstruction projects that could provide concrete help and hope to citizens across the country. Meanwhile, we would push ahead on training Iraqi forces so they could assume increasing responsibility for the country's security. In the formula we often used, as they stood up, American forces could stand down. It was a logical-sounding program for long-term success in Iraq. The problem was that it didn't match up with reality. there were serious problems still not being identified and addressed. U.S. force levels inside Iraq were insufficient and were being stretched to the limit through repeated redeployments. The troops would continue carrying an immense burden and doing it well, but ending the violence and securing the expansive country was a major challenge and problem given the force level. Reconstruction was increasingly hampered by the deteriorating security situation. Projects were slowed by the frequent attacks, thereby denying Iraqis essential services. The length of time it was taken to equip and train Iraqi forces to assume security responsibilities independent of American help was too long. And underlying it all was growing sectarian division rooted in history and fomented by insurgents, unsanctioned militias, and terrorists. American troops were doing their job well, but they could only do so much. They needed more from Washington, but it was growing more polarized as the conflict dragged on. Bush's way of managing the problems in Iraq was proving inadequate to the task. He received regular updates and held frequent meetings as he sought to improve the situation through personal persuasion and pressure on Iraqi leaders. But he was insulated from the reality of events on the ground and consequently began falling into the trap of believing his own spin. He failed to spend enough time seeking independent input from a broad range of outside experts, those beyond the White House bubble who had firsthand experience on the ground in Iraq, and perhaps most important, those with differing points of view, including those who disagreed with his policies. The failure to open up the Bush White House to fresh perspectives in the second term was already beginning to exact a price.